You have both created businesses that want to make our lives more sustainable and healthier. So let me ask, are your respective companies profitable right now?
No.
Yes.
And are you confident that they will remain or become profitable one day?
Yes.
No.
Just come over to my company.
Welcome. This is On Thin Ice, a podcast by Iceworld Media in partnership with the Bali Peak Outlook Foundation. We bring together the best athletes, scientists, and innovators to discuss concrete solutions for accelerating the transition to a more sustainable way of living. I'm Paolo Bosselin, and I'm just humbled to welcome our very impressive guests today. Joining us from Boulder, Colorado, Sasha DeJulien is one of the most recognizable names in climbing. She first became a world champion at only 18 years old, and she has since collected a long list of first ascents and achievements. Welcome to On Thin Ice, Sasha.
Thanks so much for having me today.
I saw you're now also competing in triathlon races, but would you still introduce yourself as a climber?
Definitely. I have not earned my pedigree as a triathlete yet.
Well, in any case, sports is just one of the many things you do. You are a businesswoman, a writer, a film producer. You've lobbied for climate action in Washington, D.C. And I read that a few years ago, you even designed the first climbing emoji. Is that right?
Yeah. Highlight of my career. When you use an emoji and you put in climber, it's based off of my design. So I'm happy that we can be recognized by the emoji library as a sport as well.
And we have another multi-talented entrepreneur on the podcast today, Kidus Asfaw, calling in from Nairobi, Kenya, who has won a number of awards with his startup, Cubic. Kidus and his teams transform plastic waste into bricks for building houses. He had previously worked for UNICEF and the World Bank, and he's a software engineer by training. Thanks for joining us, Kidus.
Thanks for having me.
Let's jump straight into our big question. In today's economy, many companies that want to produce and sell things in a more sustainable way face higher costs than their conventional competitors. As a result, the cost of greener goods is also higher for consumers. Take electric cars that are more expensive than diesel ones, renewable energy that sells at a premium, or in the case of groceries, foods labeled organic are more expensive than intensively farmed or highly processed foods. And those more conventional products often still dominate the market. Sasha, you know this firsthand, because among all your projects, you are also the founder of Scent Bars, a vegan food company based in Colorado. Can you tell us about your company's philosophy and why is it so much harder and more expensive to produce natural, healthy foods?
Yeah, absolutely. As a company, one of our philosophies is be good for you and be good for the planet. And finding our ingredients and sourcing them from farmers from as local as we can is really important to us because we want you to feel good with real food, no preservatives, no natural flavorings, which are just artificial additives that are unregulated and no refined sugar. So for instance, our dates are sourced from a local farm that we work with and have a great relationship with. And our fulfillment center, our co-packer, and our sustainable packaging solution company are all within the radius of our Boulder, Colorado location. But it is hard. I mean, you definitely pay a premium for quality ingredients. And therefore, with our margins, we have to be a sustainable, viable company, charge a little bit more than what you may see of the preservative pack. Shelf stable food that you see on like some of the other brands on the market. But our goal is really to just make eating healthy, clean food available and easy.
And why do you think there was a need today to create, because you created this company just a couple of years ago, if I'm not mistaken, why was there a need for healthier, better nutritional bars for athletes in this case?
Yeah, we're just over a year old, so it's been an exciting time for us. I always made my own bars in my blender because there was nothing on the market that I could find that, if it was healthy, tasted good. And if it tasted good, it was just packed full of brown rice syrup and different forms of refined sugar, packed full of natural flavorings and preservatives. And so I also wanted to have dark leafy greens that I couldn't taste, but available in my bars for my big expeditions around the world, and adaptogens, which have really helped me with my recovery, with my sport performance. They're really incredible superfoods that we incorporate into our bars. So after trying basically everything on the market, I'm pretty hard pressed to not find a bar that I haven't tried. I decided to start my own company. And the idea is really to have real whole food.
And I'm curious, Sasha, what made you decide to become a food entrepreneur at this point in your career?
I've always been a health food nut since I was a teenager. I was making my own bars. I actually registered our name Sun Bars in 2012 when I was at my dorm at Columbia University and making my bars and sending them out to my different professional athlete friends and bringing them on my trip. And it was something that I always wanted to do. Then a couple of years ago, I double hip reconstruction surgery. I was out from my sport for 9 months and I had a lot of time to refine my purpose. And this was just kind of something that was in my calling that I was like, I feel too passionate about it not to do it because it stayed with me for the last decade. So I don't know anything about the CPG world and there's a lot that I'm going to have to learn along the way. But let me just dive in and go for it because it feels like something that I can't quiet. And I think that when you have anything in life that's like that very fervor of a passion that's like you can't get rid of it, I think that you need to act on it.
Kiddos, that's probably something you can relate with, right? Before we look more into what your startup's doing, basically, I'd like to ask you the same question on a personal level. Why did you decide to invest and dedicate so much of your time to this huge, daunting task of building a green business?
So I grew up in a city. I grew up in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And I remember growing up, it being a fairly small city where everyone knew everyone. And I could walk outside and see mountains all over me or all around me. And over time, skyscrapers started to block that. But the part that actually made it even daunting for me was the smog that was covering this landscape and no longer for it to be seen. And while on pictures, the skyscrapers and the hustle and bustle looked really exciting, being on the ground showed how the effects of pollution, lack of waste management, the unaffordability that comes with a densely populated and urbanized city brings with it. And later on in life, when I was working in the UN, I had the opportunity of traveling to many other cities just like Addis Ababa, everywhere from Santiago to Yangon. And that story continued to stick with me. You know, low-income countries aren't rural anymore. They're actually metropolises. And the plight of people that can't afford a decent living involves having to face waste and very meager types of living conditions. So later on in my UN career, I had an opportunity of being able to work on a project that was able to convert plastic waste into bricks to make schools. And my life turned into trash. I became very fascinated by it. And later on, I started to really become fascinated by the market of real estate and how to make affordable housing. And that was the big pivot that I saw to later on start Cubic.
Now, kiddos, the problem you're specifically taking on is a humongous one, and that's plastic waste. Nowadays, as you also mentioned, whether you're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean or at the top of Mount Everest, you will find plastic trash everywhere. Honestly, I find that terrible on many levels. And by the way, that's a problem that our partners at the Bali Peak Outlook Foundation have also been trying to address. They have developed a program to retrieve plastic waste from Himalayan villages so that it can be processed and recycled. That's how I discovered their work. Kiddos, you're also in this field. Can you tell us exactly what you're doing, what solutions you're proposing with your startup?
So just to give you some context, the world has about 360 to 400 million tons of plastic that it throws away and does not recycle. The major culprit is the US. I think it accounts for about 60 to 70 million tons of that. Now, I've lived in San Francisco and New York, and I haven't really seen that plastic being thrown away. And that's because America is really great at hiding it. Europe is really great at hiding it. But if you come to Ethiopia, the number is about 300,000 tons a year, but it's in your face because it is not as managed and people actually face it day in and day out. So what we wanted to do at Cubic was take that plastic that has very little value in the recycling value chain and give it another chance for life that could add value to something else. And in our case, that's real estate. Real estate is also an interesting thing. You know, all of us live in a home, and we call it a home because we find some dignity in the way that it was built. We seek comfort in it. Over 300 million families around the world don't have that luxury. About 100 million of that is in Africa. So we wanted to make Cubic our home because we knew that trash can actually be removed from people's faces. And we can create a very beautiful product that is very affordable that can be used to make one of those 100 million families call home. And if we can actually prove this as a concept, we're actually having a much broader vision of giving Africa that name of being the launching pad of innovation that is eliminating plastic waste, driving affordability in housing, but even more importantly, around how we can decarbonize a very polluting sector, which is real estate. So we make bricks, we make columns and beams. We have an interlocking system that then makes a wall. The very basic component of any building is a wall. And that wall has a lot of things going into it, from the brick to the cement that holds that brick to the rebar and the aggregates that have to be brought in and the sand that has to be excavated. All of that extractive material is required to make this really simple thing. What we said to ourselves is, how do we remove all of that bad stuff to make this really necessary part of a home and actually use something like plastic waste in a way that it's still as safe, it is as structurally sound, but really importantly, very boring looking so that people don't need to even know that it is made out of plastic waste.
So key question there, you mentioned safety. Of course, we know that plastic waste can break down into microplastics, which can enter the food chain. They can be found in the water, including in our bloodstream where we're finding it, and it can cause serious health problems. How do you prevent your bricks from creating and adding to that microplastics issue?
So safety has been one of the most important parts of our business. And even before starting Cubic, a lot of our deliberation was, what are we going to make? Because we knew we can take plastic waste, mix our magic sauce, and make anything, including paving material, right? But we decided that we're going to focus on the wall for two reasons. One, this is the least impact material that you would have. If you made a pavement block, you have things being thrown at it, you have cars running over it, and that introduces microplastics into the environment. But we knew that if we were able to make a wall, that is not really an issue. So then the second issue we had to think about is, how does it environmentally not degrade as well? And the two culprits for this is water and sunlight, because it's exposed to it. So part of the formulation that we have ensures that that plastic does not leach and that it keeps that integrity for hundreds of years.
Do you think one day you could compete with the big brick making companies of today, whoever they are? And what are the biggest obstacles to achieving that?
As a matter of fact, our walls are 40% cheaper than using cement-based walls. And there's a really important reason that we had to start with this. If we ever wanted to see the light of day in commercializing our product, we knew that we had to tackle the biggest incentive for a builder, which is cost. Outside of cement being a very polluting product, it's also a very expensive and volatile product to buy. In Ethiopia alone, the price of cement has tripled in the last 2 years. So we knew that if we can get this cost significantly down and market it to builders that can buy it at scale, now we're onto something where we're not only making sure it's commercialized, but we've literally created a value chain of an environmentally friendly product that can now compete with something that's commercially available already.
Question for both of you. As a consumer, when should I expect to find those organic foods, those nutrition bars, and Kiddus, your low carbon bricks? When should I expect them to become more easily available and cheaper through the normal retail channels?
I think that from our company's stance, as we grow, then we continue to develop our relationships with our farms that we work with and with our suppliers. And I think that with food in general, it's tough to predict the costs and the cost savings that you'll have, because at the end of the day, our prices are quite competitive with our competitors. But in order to have sustainable, well-sourced food that doesn't have fillers or other non-food items involved in the ingredients, I think that's more of what you want to look for, because a dollar difference, for instance, it is something that we should all be aware of. And I don't want to discount that certain products are cheaper than others, and certain people may want to spend, you know, save a dollar here and there. But when I think about our health, and the longevity and the way in which, if you fuel yourself properly and you're aware of what you put into your body, then that can eliminate a lot of big costs down the line. And I was in Alaska actually with a microplastic scientist on an expedition, and we were collecting samples in this pristine area on Valdi, Alaska. And in every single one of our samples, there was microplastics. And so microplastics are leaching into the food that we eat, the products that we put onto our bodies. So many different things are contributing to our bloodstream. And so I think that it's just really important to monitor, like, what you put into your body. Try and be aware as much as possible of what companies' ethics are, what they're doing for sustainability as well. We contribute 1% of our gross profit to 1% for the planet. As a small startup company, we can be a little bit more nimble and very, like, environmentally forward. We're also a vegan product, so that comes with some benefits towards the planet, but it's constantly an evolving question. And it's constantly, like, as technology gets better, we can improve our own practices too. It'd be my goal that we can be a compostable wrapper. But right now, our product is too fresh, and we trialed the top technology out there for bar wrappers that could be compostable, and the shelf life viability just isn't there for foods that don't have preservatives yet. So I think that as we continue to grow in the technological space, more options for companies like mine will continue to emerge, where we can continue to sharpen our practices and get better and better.
Would it be interesting for a company like yours to lead the research and develop your own wrappers?
Absolutely. I think we'd need a little bit of investment for that, but it would absolutely be a really effective thing to do, and something that I'd love to lead the charge alongside of what we're doing already for the environment, of just being as sustainable of a business as we can be, while also being viable and surviving and reaching our goal of providing clean, healthy food to people, because that's the big prerogative of ours, is being available.
Kiddus, what needs to happen for your project to scale up and for that kind of material, for those kinds of materials to be available for everyone?
So the urgency that we feel has a lot to do with climate change more than plastic pollution. Just to give you an idea, the built environment, so the real estate sector, contributes 42% to greenhouse gas emissions. If cement was a country, it would be the third largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world. So the urgency that we've actually seen is, how do we build scalable products that can replace this really awful thing? Because if we don't do that, there's a lot more existential questions that we're going to be forced to answer very soon. But we need to convince building materials manufacturers that there are alternatives that are a lot cleaner, a lot more environmentally friendly, and also commercially viable that they can be using. The way that we see ourselves doing that first is proving out that this first product that we have is something that is commercially viable. And then also do more R&D to see if there are other ways that we can do this. Now, to your question of when are you going to be able to buy our product one day? I mean, our target is in 5 years. And it's not because you're going to see a Cubic label on it, but because you have those who supply your Home Depot licensing technology that we've developed that they can now do because they see it to be greener, but also profitable to market out in your market.
Let us know when we will find them at the local stores in London and elsewhere. Sasha, as you and Kiddus exemplify very well, building more sustainable business models for consumers is challenging, but at the same time, things are moving now, and there has never been so much investment in the so-called green economy. You have been an outspoken climate advocate for years, and today, on a macro level, do you think the tide has shifted and we are on the cusp of this big transition, or is there still too much talk and not enough action?
I think there's both. I think that we need to be using our voices as people with platforms and any audience to continue to advocate for the things that matter for our planet. We need to be electing the right people to office that understand that climate action is necessary. It's not a luxury. It's happening. And I also have optimism. I think that it's front of mind for a lot of companies. We're seeing a lot of growth within the green economy sector. And I think that as people continue to enjoy the outdoors, to do things that they love, that you see the effects that the changes in the environment are taking place in real time. And as people experience that, I think that there is like this inevitable way in which people hopefully want to get more involved and see that it's necessary. So I do think that there's a lot that we still need to do, but I think that there's a lot of innovation that's existing and growing within the space.
And at an individual level, so we talked about the macro picture, but at an individual level, do you see the effects of climate change when you travel, when you go climbing, when you're out on the trail? Of course, you've been advocating for conservation for a long time, but have you seen an improvement culturally? And when you go out, are those trails cleaner today than they were 20 years ago? Do you feel like there is more awareness and more engagement, and that this ambassadorial work you've been doing finally is working?
I see more awareness, but I also see more wear and tear on our environment and on climbing crags. I see that there's a lot more use because climbing is a growing sport, but you see more impact on the trails, more impact on the climbing areas. I think that Leave No Trace is something that organizations like Access Fund do a really great job of educating people around, but still with more people comes more room for error. And so now more than ever, it's extremely important. I work with an organization called Players for the Planet, and we did a beach cleanup in the Dominican Republic. And I was just after the Ironman 70.3 in Panama, I went to a local beach. And it was low tide, and it was littered with plastic and trash. And it's very prevalent. It's something that we're seeing more and more at our beaches, at our mountain ranges, with the fluctuations, the extreme fluctuations in weather temperatures that I've experienced firsthand on climbing expeditions. So I wish I could say like the planet looks better than 20 years ago. It doesn't. But I think that there's more awareness now that hopefully we can start becoming better stewards and starting, maybe it's not reversing, but having a better track forward.
How do you see your impact as an athlete and as an advocate? Where do you see encouraging results?
I think that there's always this give and take. My job requires travel, which is inarguably an impact on my carbon emissions. And so I try to be as aware as possible over my overall footprint on the environment. I eat probably 80-20 like plant-based diet, which isn't a solution for everything. But when I eat meat, I try and make sure that it's as well-sourced as possible. But to your earlier point, that does come with a cost. And eating well-sourced food is more expensive. Paying for offsets when I travel is one thing, but it still doesn't, it's not like a 0-to-1 equation. And so I think just being aware of when I travel, is it for a good purpose? Also using my voice and my platform. I was recently in DC testifying to Congress around policy that pertains to our outdoor spaces within climbing and advocating for the Explore Act. But there's a lot that legislatively is moving in a positive direction. The Explore Act is about protecting wilderness areas. So that pertains to hiking trails, climbing locations, different clean environmental spaces around the US. But I think that as people with voices, at least for me, I've always seen that it's great that I get to do my sport that I love for a living. But what's the point of having a platform if I don't try and use my voice for greater causes? And so I try and do the best I can. I think that I'm an imperfect advocate and I have a lot of room for growth. But through corporations and through government advocacy work, I think that we're making strides. I think that there's just strides still to be made.
So you mentioned, Sasha, there is more legislation around climate. We've seen in the US the Inflation Reduction Act and a lot of other initiatives such as the one you're participating in. And kiddos, there is also, as I mentioned earlier, more investment than ever before. Do you see a momentum in the global startup scene in terms of consumers wanting greener choices and investment meeting those aspirations and that demand?
The numbers are mind-blowing. There's over $1 trillion in VC funding just for climate tech right now, globally. I was just at COP28 in Dubai, and the number of investors that were out there just looking for opportunities was overwhelming. Now, that's the positive part. I think when you look at where that money is concentrated, some of it makes sense. It is around R&D because there is still a lot of work to be done to understand how to mitigate or remove greenhouse gas emissions. So clearly understand that. But it's also concentrated on things that are not physical. What I mean by that is if you're going to be removing greenhouse gas emissions, you're not going to do that through software. You're going to do that by having actual physical stuff that you need to build to make that happen.
And you are a software engineer.
And I am a software engineer. Now, the reason for it kind of makes sense. When you are a venture capitalist, you are looking for really, really high returns. That is what you're used to. You are an investor who made 1,000x because you invested in Facebook, right? Now, if you're going out and saying, I want to find the next Facebook in climate, it's going to be really difficult for you to find that in a hardware company like Cubic. So you end up investing in something that is more software in nature. That needs to change. We need to be looking at returns, not just from financial, but also from impact. And there needs to be more incentives placed by limited partners who are investing in these venture capitals to do that as well. I think that pressure will then allow more practical, applicable solutions to be coming into the market faster. so that we can actually solve a physical, real world problem. Now, the last part is most of that money does not see Africa. What I find fascinating about that is there's so many solutions here on the continent, incredible solutions. And I think Africans are the best innovators because we're the ones who are seeing these challenges firsthand. We are the ones who are actually seeing coastal communities flood all the time. We're the ones who have over 60% of our economy that is agricultural. So we're seeing crops fail and understand it is because the weather is changing. So we are trying to do something about it. What I would like to see is that recognition that these solutions exist already on the continent and there can be more capital that's deployed here, but also understanding that Africa is a great place to stress test a lot of these new innovations that are coming out. Half of us are under 25 years old. In less than 10 years, our population is going to be bigger than China and India combined. We already have over 100 cities that are over 1 million people in size.
Well, across all continents and across all sectors, software, hardware, US, Africa, everywhere, it's certainly been a bumpy road for green startups and even startups in general. As many as 90% of startups fail globally, according to the US Bureau of Labor Statistics. Sasha, you've written about challenges, ups and downs of life. You have been through serious injury. You've experienced social media attention and the pressure of fame since you were a teenager and the pressure of continuing to perform at an incredibly high level. And you wrote a book called Take the Lead, which is about reaching ambitious summits in life despite those challenges. So what would you tell to startup founders and entrepreneurs? Do you have any advice for anyone who would like to make a difference and start a meaningful venture in this space?
I would say, first of all, anything that is going to be exciting and something that you're passionate about, that's a great first start. And knowing it's going to always come with challenges, and you can plan and be aware of the inevitable risks and how to mitigate them, have strategies in place for when things go wrong, what will you do? Because if my experience in the mountain has been anything, it's that things always do go wrong and not according to plan, but you have contingency plans in place. And then there's also a discussion over what you do when you can't control that and what risk is worth taking. And I think that building the right team in place with your company is very important. Having transparency and communication and core principles that you wear every day on your sleeve is incredibly important for both teamwork, collaboration, and the success of the overall mission. But I think that also with my journey, it's come with so many ups and downs. And sometimes when you're in that valley, it's hard to see that you'll ever be at that peak again. And I think that that's where you have to be resilient and you have to keep pushing and you have to keep showing up. And it's about the grind. And I'd love to say I have like a very great balance, but I think that it's more like managing chaos sometimes. And I'm sure, Kudos, you can speak to this too. It's like with a startup, there is no balance. It's full on every day, but it's what you love to do. And so I think that that's one of the biggest things that I've learned in balancing everything or not balancing everything.
Kudos, what do you think?
You have to do something that you care about. Otherwise, you'll give up at some point. I think one thing that I can already see that Sasha and I would have in common is that we're doing something that we care about. So even if things failed, we don't see it as the end point. We actually see it as the process to then do it differently or do it bigger, right? And there's so many entrepreneurs, especially within the climate tech environmental space, that are doing this for the right reasons. They care, right? And they're not going to stop. And I think that's where I find radical optimism that we are going to be the ones that come up with that solution or series of solutions. One of the advice that I've always given fellow founders that are just starting their company or even my team is we always have to have a North Star and be very stubborn about sticking to that North Star, but you have to be super flexible on how you get there. There's so little that you know about the journey. Founders, I think, are crazy, foolish, and optimistic all at once, right? Like if I knew this is what it takes to have a startup, I don't know if I would do it. So there is a bit of foolishness in there. There's going to be a lot of moments where you will feel humiliated because you would feel that you made the dumbest decision and everyone saw it. But getting back up, seeing that as a process and figuring out how you can find a different way of still reaching that North Star, it's what I believe is the magic sauce for becoming a successful entrepreneur.
I'd like to ask both of you, what's been your hardest failure in life?
I have so many. I don't even know. I've, in my climbing career, matured from being a young kid and having my first sponsor at 12. Maybe my hip surgeries are one example. Like I had to relearn how to walk 3 times over the course of 6 months. And I couldn't sit up at 90 degrees for 3 months. And then again, for 3 months later, after the second side, my pelvic bone was broken into 4 pieces and then held back together by screws. But then I went on to achieve one of my hardest climbs in my career yet after being told that I might never climb again. So I think it's a lot about putting those blinders on in the direction of where you want to go too.
What I'm always thinking about is how do I not let down those that I really, really care about? I got into this business because I did not want to let down my kids for not trying to do something about how their future could be, right? We went through this exercise once at work where someone asked, what would you want your tombstone to read? And, you know, the more I thought about it, I just said, he tried, right? Even when I think about, you know, those who have believed in me to start Cubic and invested in this company, when I think about the 50 people that have believed in this mission and vision that I've set out and left whatever they were doing to come join this journey, I'm always thinking about those low moments that, you know, you just say, man, I really want to give up, but I know I don't want to let them down and I don't want to let my kids down for not trying.
Well, today, I think it's fair to say that you're both very successful individuals by all accounts, but you're also both very young. And I would like to ask, as a last question, what next?
I think of big picture is really hard to say, like, what's next in 10 years. I tend to like to break out my what's next in 2-year increments because it's a little bit more palatable and tangible. But I love that idea of like the North Star guiding you along the way and being super stubborn towards that. For me, I have climbing goals. I have a goal in Yosemite that I'll be dedicating a lot of time towards. But I also have aspirations with the company and growing and being able to expand our product line in what we offer and building our audience. And I think that all of it is just one foot in front of the other. I think that setting smart goals is really important to stay on track of the bigger goals. And those are smaller, attainable goals in the nearer future that keep you showing up and give, you know, that feedback of whether you're moving in the right direction or you need to course correct to get there. So I think that breaking the big picture down and whittling it down to smaller steps along the way is really important, both for motivation, for feedback, and for sanity.
I honestly never thought I'd be an entrepreneur. I never saw that to be a calling or something that excites me. I think just being an entrepreneur means that you get to absorb a lot of information about things that you would not typically be absorbing. And in my case, I feel like there's a lot around climate action that I've started to understand and feel very alarmed about. And also feel that I can't do alone or that my company can't do alone. So I definitely want to reimagine what cities look like I want to find ways in which people that are as motivated as I am and that my team is can also get my support in different ways. But we need more people that can do more of this stuff and try to do it bigger. And I agreed with Sasha. If I try to figure out my 5 to 10 year goal, I'll drive myself nuts. I'm trying to get through today.
I'll try to remember that.
I'd say just figure out what you feel really passionate about and continue in that direction. And know that there's often going to be noise and opinions of other people, and the internet can be a really harsh place. But I think as long as you're doing what you love, you're surrounded by the right people who believe in you, then you're on the right track.
I think one of the things we don't talk enough about at Qubic and broadly beyond that is the role women play around climate action. There's this book called Project Drawdown that quantifies solutions towards climate change. And empowering women is one of those top 10 solutions. And unless we bring them to that forefront of how they can make those decisions on what our cities look like and what our world looks like, no solution, no Qubic is going to actually change these cities. I really want to make that calling that, you know, don't take it from me as like an inspirational thing. We just read Project Drawdown. It is quantified that empowering women is extremely important.
Yeah, empowering women is extremely important. And from an equal access playing field and pay and recognition and celebration to also recognizing that we need to just in general be more welcoming to everyone.
Well, that's all very inspiring. And we'll keep covering these topics on this podcast. So maybe we'll invite you back in a bit to see how things have evolved. And I can't wait to see what other great things you will do next, respectively. Thanks for speaking with me today. Of course, this is a very vast topic, but I feel like we got to some key points, especially about what it means to be a green entrepreneur. That's incredibly valuable. Thanks for that. I'd also like to thank our great production team. Ons & Ice has original music by Nadir Kasim. Our script editor and editorial advisor is Dave Vetter. And crucially, credit goes to our partners at the Bali Peak Outlook Foundation for supporting this podcast. The foundation is very serious about defending mountains around the world from the impact of climate change and excessive tourism. Check out their website to see what they're doing. That's balipeakoutlook.org. balipeakoutlook.org. On Thin Ice is a production by Iceware Media. We have several other inspiring episodes lined up, so make sure to hit the subscribe button and download our shows. Please also give us a review on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time. Goodbye.